That's a quick main speaker tonight is Kathy M.
Hi, my name is Kathy Malloy, and I'm an alcoholic. You know, that's how I sounded at my very first meeting. Before I get started, I want to thank Tim for asking me to do this. I'll never forget the day he called me and he said, "I think you're ready." And I was hoping it was for some other task. It is truly an honor and a privilege to be speaking here tonight. If you're new, I saw a couple of people raised their hands tonight. Probably as nervous as I am. Now, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Not every meeting is like this. But this is probably one of the best meetings, in my opinion, is the best meeting in the world. You know, this is the meeting hall. I did promise my husband one thing. You know, this morning I was talking about some issue like the weather, and I burst into tears. And I turned to him and I said, "I'm not nervous, I'm PMS. So please forgive me if I get a bit emotional up here. It's not Tim's fault, it's not my husband, it's me." You know, and I jump around a lot. I swear the last few weeks you've had very eloquent, dignified, wonderful speakers, and now you have me. But next week's a new year. I was sitting at the big party they had for the group and for Clancy's birthday, and it was the first time in my entire sobriety that it occurred to me that this group has been here and was waiting here. I mean, not necessarily waiting here for me, but was here when I came in. You know, and I feel very blessed and lucky because I was the type of alcoholic that needed the activity in this group. You know, I'll try to stick to the format. You know, I was born and raised in Santa Monica, California. I know. I saw a car as my husband and I were coming over the 405. There was a car in front of us. Its license plate said Geek, and that's me. I mean, I should have gotten that license plate. I was born into a family of two scientists. My mother's a chemical physicist and my father's a physical chemist. And they've made very clear distinctions from the day I was born. You know, I always hear people talking about, you know, their dysfunctional families. I didn't have a dysfunctional family. I have a very unique neurotic and I love them, family. But they are unique. You know, when I was growing up, I tend to jump around a lot. I remember when I was new, Marianne King seemed to speak very fast. And I really related well to her, and it seems like over the years she's calmed down. So God willing, you know, if I stay sober long enough, I may slow down and be able to stay on track. But, this last week was Christmas, and I have three small kids, and, you know, my boys got remote control cars and all the boys stuff, and my daughter got Barbies. And I remember, you know, I've always joked that I never had a Barbie. You know, I had molecular building sets. I had chemistry sets. I had color forms and it was not for fun. You know, my father was over for the holidays and was explaining to my son linear equations. The boy is 7, okay? I remember my father holding our oldest when he was a newborn. And I'm giving you some insight to my family. He's holding his first grandson. He never had any boys. And he looks at him and he goes, "Look at all this gray matter just waiting to soak up information." I was raised in a very atheist household. My parents were raised very religiously, so when we were raised, we were told it had nothing to do with God. There was no crutch like religion. We could explain everything that happened in the universe, and if I questioned it, they did explain it. You know, our evening games at the dinner table were things like my father had mounted on the wall behind us a map of the world, which, by the way, he changed as the world's countries changed. And we would get quizzed, and I knew at a very young age where Abu Dhabi was, you know, and I knew things about geography. I was born on April 1st, and I have a twin. I'm telling you, Geek is my license plate. And if you're new tonight, everything I tell you about my upbringing and my childhood and my drinking and my sobriety is completely 20/20 hindsight. You know, I don't really know what I'm going through, and today I don't know what I'm going through. But I know that I'm told to show up a day at a time and just take the right actions and talk to a sponsor and read the big book and work the steps. And that's the best I know, and all I can do is tell you what I'm up to today. I don't remember my first drink. Drinking was When I say it was a way of life, it wasn't like my family was, my parents were alcoholics. They taught us from a very young age the appropriate drinks to drink, with fish and meat and the aperitifs and stuff. And in fact, my parents had this thing where if you had a really bad cough, you got Grand Marnier before bedtime, because it seems to ease that cough. And there was a time in third grade where I was out for a month from school, and I got a lot of Grand Marnier. You know, at my second year of sobriety, my parents got a divorce, and one of the things my father told me while going through the divorce was that he took over the grocery shopping when I was relatively young, you know, about 10 years old, because it appeared my mom was drinking a lot of the alcohol in the house, and he kept having to refill it, and I had to make an amends at that point and explain that indeed it was not my mother, so it was his 10-year-old daughter. Anyway, I don't remember my first drink. I remember when I came into the halls of AA the first time at 18 years old. I remember coming into a meeting, and I don't think this is what happened, because I walked into the meeting not wanting to be sober. I was not ready. I came in to get the heat off. And I remember walking into a meeting, and it seemed like everybody was about 55 years and older, which is not that old anymore. But when I was 18, it was. And what I heard them say was, "You are too young to be an alcoholic. And if you don't remember your first drink, you are not an alcoholic." And I thought, I'm out of here. You know, I didn't. Now, I have to know that was the Thursday night Brentwood meeting. They don't do that. But I heard what I wanted to hear. When we were 11 years old, we moved to Paris. My father went on sabbatical. And that's when my drinking really took off. And, you know, I was listening to Lisa when she was talking about how people asked her about her hair and stuff like that. You know, when we moved to Paris, it was around the time that Grease came out, and it was really popular. So people assumed we all ran around school singing songs and by 50s garb. And, you know, my father had the brilliant idea of, he had immersion program already in his head before they ever developed it for LA Unified School, and he threw us into a public school in Paris. And the only book we had, the only French we had learned was my father sat us down and read Le Petit Prince, The Little Prince. I mean, it's not language you use in everyday school. So when we came into the schoolyard, this is the way I, you know, the way it happened the first day at the schoolyard is the way I remember, the way I've always felt in my life. The schoolyard was about the size of this room, and all the kids were milling around, you know, speaking a language I didn't understand, and all of a sudden this little old lady with a clipboard and these glasses down here comes out and she starts reading down names. And she gets to the bottom of the list, and as she's reading the names, people are going into their little groups and lining up, and they know what to do. She gets to the bottom of the list, and I'm standing there. And my name's not on the list, and I don't have a place to go, and they're asking me questions in a language I don't understand. And that is my life. I come from a really good family. I'm one of these students who had all this potential. I had a really high IQ, and just basic things like showing up to school, answering the question, telling the truth, were not in my vocabulary at all. And so as a result of not speaking French, I got put in the lowest. They divide the grades into different classes, 1 to 13. 1 is obviously the smartest, and I got put in 13. And I went from Santa Monica school system, where I was an honors student, an accelerated student, to a class where if you drew on the table at all, the teacher took out a black felt tip pen and drew on your face. If you were caught chewing gum, they put it in your hair. If the math teacher felt you got the problem wrong, she was allowed to kick you. You know, I got. And anyway, I also learned, you know, in all this pain and tragedy, I also learned there was not a drinking age in France. And I immediately took the little skills I had, which was to sing, be able to sing every song from Greece, and what little French I had, and I hooked up with my first set of lower companions. And they were Irene and Uri. That's what their names were. And, you know, we got to drink, and they showed me how to skid through class, and I learned how to cheat there. And I had such a great time. And, you know, because of the grade level I was in, the foreign language they were learning was English, you know. And so they would, mind how you go now, ta-ta, you know, they were learning all that. So every time I cheated with a friend and they came out with, I can't do that, the teacher just looked at me. And anyway, what we did after school was we went to Irene's house, and she had alcohol, and we drank, and her parents didn't care. And I'm not saying that every kid in France is like that, but boy, I found the ones I enjoyed. And you'd think by this point my parents would start to see there was a problem. Because when I turned 13 and they asked me what I wanted for my birthday, I asked for a case of Bordeaux. I don't know what I'd do if my kids did that to me today. But, you know, the thing is, we got it because it was a really good year. And that's where, you know, I hear people all the time saying, you know, I was not loved enough. You know, I was loved till I was about to die. My parents had total denial, and they wanted the best for me. And when we came back from France, you know, oh, shoot, my watch stopped. Now I'm really in trouble. Okay, when it's 9 o'clock, everybody go like this, just so I know. I'm supposed to get sober at 9. Does anyone have a watch? No. Okay. Anyway. Okay, quickly. Throwing that out. Okay, the full moon almost, too. When we came back from France, you know, I was in junior high, and I remember my friend Julie C. when I was new, and she used to talk about people getting the Book of Life, and she used to talk about coming down the gangplank, and God would hand everybody a book, and when she came by, he sneezed, and she missed the book, you know, and I always felt like they gave out the abridged edition or the second edition in junior high, and I missed it. You know, because once again, I came in feeling weird. And the thing is, I had, oh, thank you so much. I owe you. Oh, it's nice to hear. Take mine. No, no. I like this. I am so nervous. I remember in junior high, you see, I had the taste for alcohol, and I loved it. And like I said, I was from a high-achieving family, and I came back, and I remember we had been gone so long, I had a difficult time, and I sound silly, but I felt I had a difficult time speaking English. It's very clear tonight that I still do. I came back, and I felt weird again. You know, and I don't know when I heard it, but there was a time in my life where I wanted to be cool, sought-after, famous. You know, I mean, my goal in life was to travel all over the world and pop in anywhere. I don't know where the money was going to come from, but, you know, I didn't have a goal. I just wanted to have fun. And I came back, and once again, I knew I stuck out, and I looked weird, or acted weird. So rather than just act weird, know that if I walked into a room, they'd all turn and, like, people would disassociate from me because I was a geek. I dressed differently, and people disassociated from me because I looked dangerous. And I started doing things like, you know, I'm in these AP advanced placement, you know, trigonometry and calculus classes, and I'm walking in with spiked hair and pierces all over, and everyone else is like thick glasses and long hair, and just, hi, did you work on the problem last night? And I'm like, you know, and I don't know about you, but I really feel, and it says in the, you know, in the book, sometimes we can be the most, if we really apply ourselves, we can be the most successful people. And I figured, well, if I half apply myself and I do okay, that's good enough for me. You know, and I was the type of person who wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't do the homework, and I'd take the test and I'd do well. And I flunked out of college, okay? That's another. No. You know, I started. I looked about the way I do now, and I started going out to clubs and bars. And I found, you know, I was thinking about it, sitting in the seats there. That some of my favorite drinks, if I hear them still, bring, you know, make me want. Like, I love Manhattans, Long Island iced teas. You know, it started with typical, you know, alcoholic drinks of rum and coke and 7-7s, and you know, I really thought alcoholic drank beer. I don't know why I thought, you know, a melon ball at 16 was okay. You know, I remember my parents at one point were getting, you know, for just everyday wine, the Ernest and Julio Gallo Hardy Burgundy in the big jug. And I knew I had hit pay dirt because that jug is so big you don't miss, you know, little bits except add it over a week. It's like, what happened? Yes, Mom. And, anyway, was doing a lot of clubs at night and still going to school, and I started to look very strange, and someone described it once as, here's the, you know, the Cleavers adopted an Addams Family child. I mean, I was into, like, the magic marker eyeliner, I was into the white cake makeup long before it was popular, I was bleaching my hair out, and letting the Roots show before it became trendy. You know, I want to thank Phyllis for coming tonight. Phyllis and I got sober together, and she used to do my touch-up on Roots. And if you want to have white hair and no roots, go see Phyllis. She's awesome. Anyway, my little plug. I was insane, and I knew I was insane, and the only way I could fit in was to drink. And I remember coming in, you know, like I said, I was a good student, and I wasn't, you know, I wasn't too mean, you know, a little, but not too mean, where I didn't get into a lot of trouble. Whenever I got into trouble, I'd cry, and I'd get out of it. And I don't remember consciously doing it. I mean, I remember the time when my mother was tucking me into bed when I was just a wee one, and she was tucking the blanket under, and her eyes opened wide, and she said, "Get out of bed," and she flipped the mattress, and the entire box spring was covered in quarters and nickels and dimes that I had been pulling out of my dad's coin jar. You know, I remember when I was new, hearing people, you know, talk about stealing and the charge you got from it. And there was nothing I liked more than drinking on your money. I mean, there was nothing greater. I remember when I was out there at the bars, going to the ready tellers when they didn't open on weekends, you know, when the banks didn't open, and withdrawing the money Friday night, knowing that I could try to get it back in time Monday for that check to clear. You know, and I lived like that all the time. And when I was 16, my parents felt that I was going through a bit of a crisis, so their solution was to give me a car and a gold American Express card. And I had a great drinking time, you know. I started traveling a lot on that, and I did the typical thing of I would take the money and pay back a portion of it, you know. And I remember when my sponsor had me go back to my father in sobriety and make the amends, and I walked into his office and told him, you know, I'm sober, blah, 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 I need to make amends, blah, blah. And he turned around and he grabbed a ledger and opened it up and had everything down to the penny with interest. And he even had the money, you know. I said to him, "Well, there's the money I stole from your wife." He says, "I have that." You know, I'm the type of daughter, I am one of those daughters, the nightmare daughter. You know, my father was in a coma in the hospital, and I decided to go to Hawaii to deal with it. You know, and he comes out of the coma, and his sister's calling and saying that his daughter's flat drunk on the streets in Hawaii. You know, and it was not something I was proud of, and my parents wanted to know what was wrong. And in fact, this last week I flew up to Seattle after Christmas. My family was having a family Christmas up there. You know, and it'll be 12 years, January 15th, that I've been sober. And 12 years ago this month, my parents were still locking their purses and wallets in the file cabinets at night. My mom was sleeping with the key under her head between the pillowcase and the pillow. I remember in sobriety, I remember that it was this month, 12 years ago, that apparently, I didn't realize this until I was sober a couple of years. I had driven by a nativity scene at someone's house in Glendale, and they had, you know, had a real nice nativity scene. And the type of stuff we did was really just senseless destruction. We took the Virgin Mary and drove over her several times. And I didn't remember this until about a month before my wedding, and I got married in the Catholic Church. Pat had a great time. You know, I had to go tell Father Chuck this, and, you know, I think his retribution for me was, well, we had some things I had to do, but he also mentioned my pregnancy during my Mass. Oh, and by the way, anyway, we had a lot of fun at our wedding, you know. Anyway, long story short, I went downhill fast. You know, I traveled a lot, not notifying anyone when I was going or where I was going. My parents literally kept a schedule on me according to the bills that came in, or if they heard friends calling me saying, "Is she back yet?" You know, and I wasn't living at home, but I never had a consistent address. I had an apartment for a while, and it was next to some drug dealers. The only way we knew that was they had a couch and a scale, you know, and that was their entire furniture. And by this time, you know, I had discovered that I had gotten into a lot of speed and coke, and I found that I could drink a lot more, and I felt I didn't black out. And I drank and drank and drank. And, you know, I had gotten accepted to UCLA, which is where my father teaches, and he's taught for a long time, and If you're an alcoholic like me and you don't have to show up to class, you don't, especially on Mondays, Thursdays, or Fridays. And during the 80s, it was also Wednesdays because it was Dynasty Night. You see, by this point, my drinking had progressed, but a friend of mine suggested that I not drink in straight clubs because, you see, Velcro clothes were in. I don't know if you remember that hot trend. It quickly went out because I think alcoholics couldn't deal with it well. I had Velcro shirts, I'd walk in looking great, Velcro pants, and by the end of the evening, they had all open wide and, you know, I was being ushered out. So anyway, it was recommended to me that I, you know, and I'd gone into UCLA theater and I discovered West Hollywood. And I'll tell you, there is not a town in this world made for partying like West Hollywood. We'd go to the clubs, we'd go to the tea dances, we'd go to the after-hour club, you know, places like Probe. That was a fun place. And I didn't get into as much trouble. You know, I did get into trouble with the people who were questioning their direction, but whatever. But I became the cute, you know, I was wearing costumes from a long time. You know, I started showing up in 40s outfits, 50s outfits, like I said, you know, punk. I was just doing everything on the outside possible, you know. I was making friends with the bartenders, and I felt like queen of the queens. I'd walk in and hand the bartender my purse, and I'd be there dancing, and anyone would buy me a drink, and it was great. And, you know, New Year's was just a blast. Like I said, at 18, I came to a meeting because I was about to be kicked out of UCLA. And I got kicked out not because I failed classes, but I either failed to withdraw, you know, or I withdrew too many times. I'm the type of person who starts every new year with a good resolution, and within a few weeks, it's like, you know, what's the bother? I'm having too much fun. And if you're new here tonight, you know, and I don't know about you, but when I got sober at 20 years old, and I thought that, you know, the rest of my life would be this long gray hall, you know, and it would be boring. And I'm here to tell you that if you're a person like me, an alcoholic like me, it's got to be fun and exciting to stay sober, and this group provides that. You know, Trey was over for Christmas, and he said something just in passing that really hit home to me about this group. He said, you know, I was around last year, and I saw these people singing these songs, and I thought to myself, how did they know about that? I've been in this group, and I didn't hear about that. And I looked at him and I thought to myself, you know, that's the beauty of this group. You can be as active as you want and you can be involved in everything. But at the same time, if you choose not to be active, you're going to feel an outcast. I mean, it really, the sobriety and the gift is right here. But you have to reach out for it. You know, and anyway, I thought the nerves would dissipate by now. Went on a lot of drinking, trying to get sober. I didn't do any controlled drinking. I did this. Friday night, I'd be like, okay, I'm not going to drink today. An hour later, I'd be out and gone. I don't remember taking the first drink. I don't remember when I changed my mind. I just remember I couldn't stop. And I was drinking all the time, and I was drinking around the clock, and I was getting pulled over a lot, and I got away a lot. And I remember one night, December of 96, being pulled over at about 3 in the morning, and I had two flat tires, and I was on the 5 freeway going nowhere, you know, and the cops pulled me over, and I handed them my real ID instead of my fake ID, and the guy said, have you been drinking? Just a little, you know, and I was crying, and I told him my boyfriend broke up with me, and he said, where does he live? And I'm like, right off this off-ramp, and I went to the house, and I got into a fight, and the neighbors called the cops, and the same cops showed up. And he asked me to be quiet a second time, and I stayed inside for a good half hour, and then I walked out the back door, and I was heading out to the front where my car was parked, and they were sitting there waiting for me. And I don't know if they waited that whole time or if somebody called them, but they immediately grabbed me by my shoulders, took me to the front door, rapped on the front door. When he opened it, they said, she's yours. You know, and he had it. There was no one left. My family was tired of having me around. My twin sister said she didn't know what evil seed had been implanted in me, but that I was not welcome around the family anymore. My older sister, see, 6 months prior to that, I had gone on a suicide attempt to Europe. You know, I look at it now as this, you know, I did what I call pseudo-suicide attempts, where I'd like stand at the top of the Las Vegas Hilton, waiting for someone to come running, saying, we know what's wrong with you, but no one ever did. But I was too chicken to die. You know, I didn't want to live anymore. I understood 24 hours a day long before I got to AA, because I'd wake up in the morning wishing I were dead. And I'd get through the day, and at night I'd pray to God. I didn't know I had a higher power, but I'd pray to God that I'd die, you know, in my sleep. I didn't want to be the one to do it, but I didn't want to go through this agony anymore. And I couldn't stop drinking. And I was having DTs. And I was sneaking. Anytime I went into someone's house, I checked their liquor cabinet and their medicine box, you know. And when I was 19, I took the American Express card and I went to Europe. Of course, what I did was I took the card to my dad's office and said, "Here, I'm done. I can't do it anymore." What he didn't know was I had already reported that one lost, had the new one in my pocket, and was gone to Europe. You know, I'm the type of person, someone mentioned it before, you know, I stole $20 from a girl who worked for me at work, you know, who worked under me, and when she came back from lunch and found the $20 missing, I was really gracious enough to lend her the money to get through the week. You know, those are really tough amends to make. You know, the big ones, it's like, "Hi, loser, let me pay you back." But the ones where you call up and say, "You remember that $20 you lost? I took it. You know, no, you lent me the money." "No, I know, but I also took it." Anyway, I went to Europe, and this was long before check systems and stuff. I started writing bad checks. And I wrote bad checks to American Express. And while the card was gold and it was in my name, it went straight to my father's accountant. Within 2 months, you know, I wasn't touring the Europe that you see in the brochures. I was going to places like the Grotto. And I was throwing up out of hotel rooms into convertibles, you know, from the second floor. I was drinking the cheapest wine. And I'll tell you, there's some really good cheap wine in Europe. Either that or my taste was non-discriminatory at that point. Anyway, I finally did what I always do, and I called my dad and I asked for help. And he sent me a ticket back, and I came back, and by this point my parents were done. There was nothing more to do. My father asked me how my trip was, asked me what I went and saw, and then that was it. My mother asked that I not come around the house. She feared for her life. She had good reason to. And I truly had no place to go. But I did still have a job. You see, I'm not an alcoholic. I took a 2-month leave of absence, unbeknownst to them. But I came back to the job because I'm an alcoholic who works really hard when I show up. And what I didn't know was there was a woman there who had been in Al-Anon for years. And she turned to me one day and she said she knew I had no place to live. She knew what I looked like and she knew I was shaking. She knew I only showed up on Tuesday, Wednesdays, and Thursdays by this point. And I'd show up before everyone else got there because she knew I had to take some things to get going. And I left right at about 3 o'clock because that's when I was done. And I was barely holding on. And she said, "Do you think you might be an alcoholic?" And I said, "Maybe." And she took me to a meeting. I was at that meeting and I said, "My name's Kathy and I'm an alcoholic." And that's exactly how I said it. And I'll tell you something, if you're new tonight, you know, at that third meeting, 3 days later, I don't know why I forgot there were evening meetings. I was at the 3 days later, I was at my third meeting and a woman turned to me and said, "Could you lead the meeting?" And I thought, okay. And she said, "It's a book study. We're on step." I didn't know what a step was. I'm sure they had said it, but I was not. If you're new like I was, it goes in one ear and out the other. I did not know what it was. And there was a woman, Linda H., who used to be a member of this group who was at that meeting, and she said to me, let me meet you at this Thursday night key group meeting." And I said, okay. And I walked in the door, and Keith B. was the secretary, and I walked right by him, and he grabbed my hand. He said, "My name's Keith. It's nice to meet you. You're new." Now, I don't know how he'd know I was new. I was wearing a beach bathrobe with black spandex leggings long before they were popular, and big Italian boots, and my hair was spiked, and I had the peacock makeup and the big earrings, and I was dressed to go. And I remember meeting Norma at that meeting, and Tina, and Michelle. I mean, all these things. It's funny, I was looking for my daughter's Social Security card today, and I came upon a file that I have, which are my PG Christmas lists, and I have the one from 1987. And I had highlighted them. What was so satisfying was, I'd say about 95% of the people I highlighted are still here today. You know, and you don't find that. You see, we're alcoholics. We're not supposed to stay sober. This is not my normal state. My normal state is, you know, Phyllis and I were talking about a woman who lives in her building who was, Phyllis passed by yesterday, and, you know, she was flat on her, flat on the ground, and Phyllis didn't know if she was alive or dead, and she had to rush her to the hospital. 5 minutes. Okay. Anyway, okay, your watch is slow. Yeah. I got sober in this group. I got involved. I got onto the softball team. Tom Wilson was the coach, you know, and I played softball and I was in meetings, and I was here about a week, and I was sitting at the Wednesday night meeting, and I don't know who the speaker was or what they said, but what I do know is for a split second I knew I wanted what you had. I didn't really want it before, but I knew I didn't want it out there, but all of a sudden I wanted this. And the woman behind me handed me her card, and Michelle was sitting next to me, and she said she'd be good. And that's how I got a sponsor. And if you're new here tonight and you don't have a sponsor, get one, because I'll tell you, I have the same sponsor 11 months, and 2 weeks later. Her husband referred to me as the albino from outer space. And what happened was Pat never told me to change the way I look. She knew that I'd want what you had inside, and that the outside wouldn't matter as much. And I started showing up, and I started making notes amends. And one of the amends I made was, I went back to UCLA, where when I was about to be kicked out, I went to the counselor and told her that my father was having an affair with a student. Because I knew she couldn't tell anyone, and I wouldn't get kicked out. And I had to go back to this woman and tell her that that was not indeed true, that I was an alcoholic, and that I had done that to lie to get to cover my butt, basically. And what happened was, not too long afterwards, my father was accused of sexual harassment. And I'm here to tell you that he was not guilty. But if that had been on record, I don't think he would have gotten out of it. And you know, his lawyer called me at one point during the case and said to me, I wanted to tell you such and such because your father has said what a great support you've been to him. And that's not me. When I was about 3 years sober nine years ago, I had a horseback riding accident. And I don't know about you, but the majority of the people in this group are a little busy on New Year's Eve. If you're new here tonight, we have a big New Year's Eve bash. Please go. If you can, get tickets. I'm sorry, I probably messed it up now. We'll call someone. Anyway, I was in the hospital, and I called Vince. I called Vince because they wanted to put me under, and I'm telling the doctor, you can't, I'm sober, I can't take anything from the neck up. And I called Vince, and he's, go into surgery, quick, you know, and because I didn't want to lose my sobriety. This was everything, and for about 4 months there, I couldn't come to meetings. And I got better, I was active again, because I missed this group like crazy. And one day, while I was on crutches, apparently my husband-to-be saw me and just thought I was a vision of beauty, you know, no, right? And, I had lost a job. I was beginning at square one. I had 3 years of sobriety, and I had nowhere to go, and I had a lot of bills, and I had no job. And I started working for Tim Kaye. That's how I got this. No, I'm kidding. No. I started working for Tim, who's a secretary. And we had a great time. People would say, how do you know each other? We'd look at each other and go, she plays softball with my wife. Yeah, that's it. Anyway, when they talk to you about you'll marry the person you least expect, I kept looking at the people who came in from the midnight mission going, you know, could work. But Jim was the person I least expected, you know, because he was everything that I wasn't looking for. He was successful. He was a good person. He was honest. You know, I was more into the loser. That was my category. And we started dating, and we dated. We got engaged. We got pregnant. We got married just about that fast. And what's happened is, you know, January we'll be married 8 years, and we have three beautiful children, 7, 5, and 3. And you know, when my 5-year-old was about 8.5 months old, she got spinal meningitis and encephalitis. And I was afraid of this. I wish I'd get over it, you know. And it changed her, and she suffers from seizures. And you know, Pat just told me, just show up. That God's put her in your life for a reason. And you know what? Not once did I think of drinking. Yeah, I thought of killing the doctors, screaming. Screamed at God one night, how dare he give this virus to my daughter? You know, and then I realized I was out of step with my spiritual program a little. I think the worst night was a couple of months ago. I had lost it completely, and my son had upchucked an entire birthday dinner over the carpet, and I took out the scissors and was cutting the piece of carpet. I mean, we have new carpeting at our house now. So. You know, I really depend on these meetings. Anyway, Pat just and calling my sponsor. Pat had told me to show up and do the next step, and it out of the blue, it came out that sign language helped her. Go figure. She's not deaf, but sign language works. It's the thing that breaks through. And I looked at it the way I look at my Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, to Joe Blow out there, I haven't had a drink in 12 years. I don't need a meeting. You know, I can understand the rest of the world, but I don't know about you. If I'm out there without a meeting and without a sponsor, without the big book in the program and newcomers, I get squirrely. And I hear things differently than you do. And I process things a lot differently than the normal person. And it's very much like my daughter. You know, she's out there listening to things without the sign language. For some reason, it doesn't get through. And I looked at it that way. And I looked that I was being of service. And I learned sign language. And the funny thing is, Jim here and I have become friends over the last few years. Jim got sober a few days after me. You know, and he used to say I was snotty and never said hi, which I wasn't. But it's opened up a whole new world. You know, I'm helping my daughter, and I get to learn about another alcoholic in the room. You know, and I'm not a perfect AA member. You know, I'm not a perfect wife, and I'm not a perfect mother. And there are many days I don't work the perfect program. But what I do have is I have a sponsor who I call. You know, newcomers tell me, I don't want to call my sponsor every day. And I have a simple solution. You see, for me, I call my sponsor close to every day, still, at 12 years. And the only reason I do, other than I love and admire you and adore you, Pat, is that I know from when my daughter was in the hospital, I need to know that number by heart. I need to know that number like my home number. You know, I need to know Verlet's number by heart. I need to know my good friend's numbers by heart. So that if I'm stuck somewhere and I'm about to lose it or I'm about to go crazy, I have that number to call. You know, like I said when I started this talk, I feel very blessed that this meeting, you know, and this group was here for me. And it truly was here for me. You know, Clancy with the yard, it saved my life when I was new. And the watches, I mean, this group does things above and beyond most groups. And it's not, maybe not necessarily for every alcoholic, but for an alcoholic like me, it's not only given me a completely different life, it's given me the desire to lead this completely different life. It's given me the joy, the desire to be a good citizen, a good mother, you know? It's made me want to be a good wife. It's, you know, I wish if you were new, I could show you. They always say, write a list of the things you want and look at it years later. My list was nothing, nothing like this. It was, you know, and I'm just a housewife. That's all I am. But I'm a sober alcoholic, which is a miracle. I am a person who would much, by nature, needs to drink more than breathe. You know, and I haven't had to take a drink, and I have all of you to thank for it. Thank you.